Radio Prague News.
President Václav Klaus, as well as other public figures, have marked the 16th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution. Pakistan's Foreign Minister Mian Khurshid Mahmood has thanked the Czech Republic for humanitarian aid, and Czech midfielder Tomáš Rosický, who scored the Czechs' lone goal against Norway in final World Cup qualifying, is said to have played on painkillers. President Václav Klaus, as well as the Prime Minister and other public figures, have marked the 16th anniversary of the Velvet Revolution. 16 years ago this day, an attack by riot police on students on Prague's Národní třída sparked mass protests that led to the eventual fall of Czechoslovakia's communist regime. Speaking with journalists on Thursday, President Klaus described November 17, 1989 as, quote, a key moment in Czech history. He said those who'd experienced the events that followed experienced the birth of freedom. Mr. Klaus laid flowers at the site where students were attacked 16 years ago. Pakistan's Foreign Minister Mian Khurshid Mahmood has thanked the Czech Republic for humanitarian aid sent to help Pakistan with recovery from a devastating earthquake in October. He made the statement in Islamabad during a visit by his Czech counterpart Cyril Svoboda. Originally, the Czech Republic donated aid worth 110 million crowns. That's the equivalent of roughly $4.3 million. Czech midfielder Tomáš Rosický, who scored the Czechs' lone goal against Norway on Wednesday to secure the national side's first appearance at the Football World Cup since 1990, is said to have played on painkillers. He had been doubtful with injuries to his knee and ankle. In the end, the player opened the scoring in the 35th minute at Prague's Sparta Stadium, leading the Czechs to win the final playoff 2-0 on aggregate. I'm Jan Wellinger. That's the news.
You're listening to Radio Prague, the international service of Czech radio, with me, Peter Smith. This is our special November the 17th programme. This is, of course, a holiday here in the Czech Republic. Later, we'll be looking into the legacy of the Habsburgs in Central Europe. But before then, many of you will be aware of why this is a special day, November the 17th, about the events of 1989 and the demonstrations that led to the fall of communism. But November the 17th was already a special date from 50 years earlier, when the students in Prague demonstrated against their Nazi occupiers. Brian Kennedy looks into that.
On the 28th of October, 1939, Czechoslovak Independence Day, Czech students took to the streets to demonstrate against Nazi occupation of their country. The protest was brutally suppressed, with shots fired at random into the crowd. One student leader, Jan Opletal, was seriously wounded and later succumbed to his injuries. Thousands turned out for his funeral procession, and protests again turned violent. Hitler ordered a swift and brutal clampdown. On the 17th of November, 9 students, seen as ringleaders, were executed, and over 1,000 were sent to concentration camps. This anniversary is marked worldwide as International Students' Day. It has a further significance for Czechs. It was the 50th anniversary of these events, in November 1989, that sparked the Velvet Revolution, which saw the beginning of the end of communist rule. In today's special program, we recount the events that led the Allies to sacrifice Czechoslovakia in the vain hopes of preventing war, and the martyrdom of Jan Opletal.
Czechoslovakia is prepared to defend her territory and will not voluntarily give up any part of it.
A pre-war radio address by Czechoslovak President Edvard Beneš, in English and meant for foreign consumption, in which he promises the young democracy will not surrender its borderlands to Nazi Germany without a fight.
The soldiers know that they would be defending a just cause.
Adolf Hitler's remilitarization of Germany's Rhineland had compelled Beneš to fortify Czechoslovakia's borders at a fantastic rate. Over half of the federal budget from 1936 to 1938 went towards preparing for the eventuality of war with Nazi Germany. Citing fabricated reports of Czechoslovak oppression, Hitler was demanding that the country's German-speaking border regions, the Sudetenland, be annexed to the Third Reich.
How horrible, fantastic, incredible it is that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. It seems still more impossible that a quarrel which is already settled in principle should be the subject of war.
British Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's now infamous words, encapsulating Britain's policy of appeasement towards Nazi Germany. Days later, on September 30th, 1938, Chamberlain, Hitler, Mussolini, and the French Prime Minister signed the Munich Agreement, which ordered Czechoslovakia to give up the Sudetenland. President Beneš, who was not invited to the talks, had little choice but to turn over his country's newly built system of fortifications without a fight. He resigned on October 5th and soon went into exile in fear of his life.
Ich bin Mr. Chamberlain dankbar für all die Bemühungen. Ich habe weiter versichert und ich wiederhole es hier, dass wenn dieses Problem gelöst ist, für Deutschland es kein territoriales Problem in Europa gibt.
Adolf Hitler, disingenuously thanking Chamberlain for his hard work, assures the world that once the Sudeten question is solved, Germany would have no further territorial claims in Europe. Privately, Hitler complained to his SS bodyguards, "That fellow Chamberlain has spoiled my entrance into Prague," for he wanted to stage a lightning strike on the Czech capital and enter a conquering hero. Chamberlain returned to Britain with the promise of having won peace in our time.
God bless you, Mr. Chamberlain. We're all mighty proud of you. You look swell, holding your umbrella. All the world loves a wonderful fella. So carry on, Mr. Chamberlain. You know we're all with you. And when we shout, God bless you, Mr. Chamberlain, our hats go up to you. Come on, everybody!
God bless you, Mr. Chamberlain.
God bless you, Mr. Chamberlain. Such was his popularity in October 1938, a song praising the British Prime Minister's diplomacy entered the charts. But the peace that came at Czechoslovakia's expense was short-lived. Months before Munich, and after the annexation of Austria into the Third Reich, Hitler had told his generals of his unshakable will that Czechoslovakia be wiped off the map, and ordered plans drawn up for a full-scale invasion.
Wir haben nun allerdings eine Aufrüstung vollzogen, wie die Welt sie noch nicht gesehen hat.
We now have arms to such an extent as the world has never seen, boasted Hitler after taking control of Czechoslovakia's fortifications. I have spent billions in the last 5 years, and the German people must now know what the purpose of that was.
Ich habe nun in diesen 5 Jahren tatsächlich errüstet. Ich habe die Milliarden dafür verwendet, das muss das deutsche Volk jetzt wissen. Ich habe...
The sound of German troops marching through Prague's Wenceslas Square on the 15th of March, 1939. After 6 months of the Second Republic, as the rump state of Czechoslovakia, minus its border regions, was known, Bohemia and Moravia were occupied by the Nazis.
Vlohil jsem osud českého národa do rukou vůdce.
I have entrusted our country to the Führer and been promised his trust. Dr. Emil Hacha, the aging president who replaced Beneš, told the nation upon his return from a meeting with Hitler in Berlin. Legend has it that Hacha suffered a mild heart attack after being delivered the ultimatum to allow the Wehrmacht to enter Czechoslovakia unchallenged or see the Luftwaffe reduce Prague to ashes. A jubilant Hitler declared, "Czechoslovakia has ceased to exist," before leaving Berlin to witness the raising of the swastika above Prague Castle.
The period which followed after the agreement of Munich was one of the saddest in the history of Czech nation.
Historian David Kraft.
It was a situation of great disillusion, I must say. The fact that the country was abandoned by her allies led to the certain feeling of loneliness. Of course, a lot has changed on the 15th of March when the German units occupied the rest of Czechoslovakia and when the so-called protectorate was called. I would say, in a way, it was a positive step in that respect that it clearly showed that any promises of Hitler had no validity. All the guarantees given to the Western powers in Munich for the rest of Czechoslovakia also ceased to exist.
When the German army marched on Prague, Jan Opletal, a young man who in martyrdom would come to symbolize the tragic fate of the occupied Czechoslovak nation, was in his fourth year of medical school at Charles University. An energetic and popular student from a small town in Moravia, he had been elected vice president of the dormitories. In the early days of the German occupation, in some ways life went on as normal. President Hacha stayed in office, and on one level a Czech government remained in place. Yet the protectorate had been incorporated into the German Reich and was directly subordinate to its laws under the supervision of Reich Protector Baron Konstantin von Neurath.
Unser geliebter Führer, Sieg!
Heil!
Sieg!
Heil!
The Gestapo had assumed police authority.
Sieg! Heil!
The outbreak of war would change everything.
No one knows what is going to happen within the next 24 or 48 hours. I don't think that either Chamberlain or Hitler really know at this minute. But one thing is very definitely sure. If the war starts, it will be Hitler who is the guilty party.
On the eve of the September 1st, 1939 Nazi invasion of Poland, a furious Czechoslovak foreign minister in exile, Jan Masaryk, speaks out on the BBC against further futile attempts at appeasing Hitler.
I do not wish to deny that the unbelievable policy of the Western democracies has helped Hitler to this fortunate or tragic position. It is the terrible tragedy of my little country that it had to be crucified to redeem the sins of others.
6 weeks into the Second World War came what would have been the 21st anniversary of the Czechoslovak Declaration of Independence had the country not de facto ceased to exist. Jan Opletal and his fellow medical students began drafting leaflets calling on Czechs to defy the Nazi protectorate and turn out for a mass demonstration on the 28th of October. All Czech patriots were to wear their Sunday best, as if for a funeral, with the forbidden red, white, and blue tricolors pinned to their lapels. The evening before the planned demonstration, flowers began to appear on graves, monuments, and other sites of historic significance to the Czechoslovak nation. Protectorate authorities warned Czechs not to take part, promising that unlawful assembly could only lead to suffering. Despite the official warnings, hundreds turned out in the Prague city center for peaceful demonstrations. As the day grew on, they became increasingly bold, singing the national anthem in both Czech and Slovak, shouting anti-German slogans, and demanding the return of Beneš and a free republic once more. Groups of Czechs, many of them students, vandalized German storefronts, while a sympathetic Czech police force did little to intervene. German civilian police were called in, with orders to fire into the crowd. 15 Czechs were wounded that day. Václav Sedláček, a 22-year-old baker, was killed, and Jan Opletal mortally wounded. Josef Jira knew Opletal well and was chosen to carry a wreath to his grave.
He was a fine young man, very smart, a student par excellence. You know, bullets don't choose their victims. We were all in a huddle, and then mounted police officers pushed the crowd away from Wenceslas Square. There were German civilian police who had guns equipped with silencers. Jan was close to the National Museum and drifted with the crowd. At first, he didn't realize that he'd been shot. He just felt a kind of stinging sensation. In fact, he'd been shot 7 times. In the dormitory, we kept the shirts he'd been wearing. It was full of bullet holes and caked with blood. Jan's fellow medical students went to see him in the hospital. We were sure that he pulled through, but at 11 o'clock they came back with the news that he was dead.
Václav Sedláček, the baker, was buried November 4th in Prague's Beranek Cemetery under strict Nazi supervision. Jan Opletal died a week later. Some historians believe the protectorate may have allowed for his funeral march to proceed on the 15th so as to provide a pretext for the crackdown on universities that was to follow. Czech authorities had arranged for Opletal's body to be quietly taken by train back to the Moravian village of his birth, and the dean of the medical faculty appealed to students not to demonstrate. Some 4,000 turned out for a procession that began at Albertov and continued on to Wenceslas Square, the same path that, 50 years later, would be retraced by the student leaders of the Velvet Revolution, which brought an end to communist rule. What began as a silent vigil turned loud and violent. In the early hours of November the 17th, 1939, Nazis began rounding up university students. 9 of them, presumed ringleaders, were executed without a trial. Some 1,200 others, including Josef Hira, were sent to labor and concentration camps. Defiance against the Nazis would go forever underground.
Brian Kennedy there with that look at the events of November 1939. Now we're going to continue with Colleen O'Connor, and he is in conversation with a professor about the history of the Habsburgs in Central Europe.
Robert J.W. Evans, a professor of history at Oxford, is one of the world's leading authorities on the historical development of Central Europe. Among other things, he has written a prize-winning history of the Habsburg Empire, which is considered required reading for anyone interested in the evolution and legacy of the Habsburg monarchs, who dominated this part of the world for 6 centuries up to the end of the First World War. Having started his academic career as a linguist, Professor Evans is also well known for his analysis of the role language played in the history of Central Europe and the impact it had on this region's political and cultural development. I spoke with the professor when he was in Prague recently to receive an honorary doctorate from Charles University, a place where he had studied as a graduate student in the 1960s. I started by asking him how it felt to be coming back to receive this honour nearly 40 years later.
Oh, I'm immensely gratified because I'm extremely fond of Prague, and I have had some kinds of connections with the university here since my own student days in the 1960s. So to that extent, it's a high honour which I'm extremely pleased about. It's always nice to feel that one's work is appreciated. For decades, it was really only in private rather than in public that Czech colleagues could say they thought I was saying something interesting. After 1989, it's become, of course, possible to take a broader view here, and I feel extremely flattered that my work is taken seriously, is translated and discussed and so on. And the other thing I should add, on a less personal way, that of course the Charles University is a remarkably important central institution in the history of the Czech lands, and to that extent a formal association like this with a place which contributed to the development of the Hussite movement, which led to the Reformation, which contributed enormously to the rise of Czech national culture in the 19th century. These things make it extraordinarily gratifying to be brought on board, as it were, one of the premier academic institutions of Central Europe.
You also have an interest in the role of language, or rather languages, in the historical development of the region. Could you perhaps give us some examples of the influence language had on the historical evolution of Central Europe?
Well, no one would question that the diversity of languages in Central Europe has been an important historical factor. That is pretty obvious. But it does tend very often to be subsumed in the notion of nationality, as if nationality and language ran together. Well, of course, if we look more broadly across Europe and the world, we know perfectly well that they don't necessarily run together. But equally then, I think for that reason we ought to explore what lies behind the sort of nationalism that is very intimately linked with language. And we shouldn't just ignore the practical and technical features of language, which may be important in this sort of context. There are very practical ways in which people have to respond in certain situations with or without competence in a given language, and there are certain structural features of languages which are very important. I would mention just one example which is relevant in the context of Czech. Czech, like Hungarian, for example, is a language which can't distinguish between people who live in the country which the Czechs live in and people who are ethnically Czech. So, of course, Český stands for them both, and Češi are those who live in Bohemia. This, in the age of nationalism, made for extraordinary difficulties in distinguishing those who did not regard themselves as ethnic Czechs but shared the territory of Bohemia, that's to say primarily Germans, sometimes Jews, particularly in some ways after 1918 when Czechoslovakia came into existence, and the language of state in the first Czechoslovak Republic was automatically a way of dividing and alienating rather than unifying the various national groups who lived in the country, and that had huge political consequences.
Would you say it kind of engendered an antipathy among ethnic Germans towards the Czechoslovak state, which would have made a contribution to their fairly wholehearted acceptance of Hitler's annexation of the country?
Well, the linguistic dimension of this was quite considerable. It's a very interesting case because, of course, as we know, the first Czechoslovak Republic was democratic. In many ways, it was genuinely democratic. It had elaborate regulations for language, as for many other things, and those regulations on paper were really quite generous to the other languages of the country. But there is no question there was a language of state. The Czech or Czechoslovak, which meant for practical purposes Czech inside the Czech half of the Republic and Slovak inside the Slovak half. But even within the Czechoslovak entity, of course, there were frictions about what actually constituted the correct language and the nature of various dialects. And of course, a lot of Czech speakers did still regard Slovak as being a kind of dialect. But that was a limited problem compared with the difficulties faced by Germans and others in trying to assert what they took to be their rights, especially the rights of Germans. So there was an animosity there, which was in substantial measure actually generated by the features of the languages themselves.
Getting back to the Habsburg Empire, do you think the shared historical experiences of the countries that once formed the Habsburg Empire has left them with some common characteristics that persist to this day?
Oh, well, there's no question about that. Of course, everyone knows about cuisine, for example, and a good deal of the older architecture. There are other features which one can say are of a sort of Habsburg kind. I don't think one should indulge in too much nostalgia about that. There are features which are capable of development and which, of course, in the different countries do develop to some extent in different ways. But underlying this, of course, are very conspicuous, to me at least, having knocked around the area for quite a long time now, conspicuous features about the way in which people react, the sort of way in which, even reverting to the question of language, the way in which they speak, because the languages may be extremely diverse, but there are forms of speech which are recognisably common in the areas where the Habsburgs ruled for a substantial period of time, at least the central parts of the empire. And these do create certain kinds of common tradition, which perhaps are a little bit more recognised now than they used to be, although people are not necessarily aware of them and not necessarily happy if they're drawn to their attention. But one good example, I suppose, would be the nature of certain kinds of bureaucratic process, which in Prague, I suppose, will always nowadays be thought of as being the world of Franz Kafka. Of course, the world of Franz Kafka was very much the world of the Habsburg administration, not by any means to be viewed in a purely negative sense. I think Kafka himself was a very diligent bureaucrat in his own job, looking after the problems of the insurance of workers. So there were lots of people like Franz Kafka who did actually a very competent job, but the important thing is that they did very much the same kind of job right across the Habsburg monarchy. And to that extent, the legacy is with us still.
Do you perhaps have any examples of the forms of speech that might prevail within what was once the Habsburg Empire?
There are some underlying features of the way the languages are pronounced, which linguists sometimes say form part of an overall pattern. But, of course, it's more at the level of words which are used in administration, in schooling, and in other kinds of common tradition from the old days of the monarchy. The most famous, of course, are the culinary expressions, which are either the same words or are direct translations of the same words in the various languages.
As a historian of this part of the world, would you care to speculate on some of the historical issues that might be crucial or relevant to the future development of Central Europe?
Well, I don't think one needs to justify study of the history of the Habsburg lands and so on in terms of contemporary politics. Nevertheless, it's evident that there are all sorts of issues today which are better understood if one has some kind of sense of that historical background. I don't believe that one can relate directly the sort of issues which were faced a century and more ago by a multinational empire in Central Europe to the sort of issues we face today. In some ways, the changes have been, of course, very substantial, and new kinds of linkages have developed and others have fallen away, which were important in the past. Nevertheless, quite a lot of the earlier traditions did survive. They're not by any means identical in the different countries of present-day Central Europe, of course. Nevertheless, there are features there which are perhaps relevant. Certainly politicians and other commentators should not be ignoring them when they look at the way in which this part of the world is going to respond to certain kind of challenges or impulses of the present. Certainly those who were reasonably familiar with the history of the region around about 1989 would not necessarily have predicted the events of 1989. We're not futurologists. We weren't probably very good at seeing when the communist structures in the region would fall apart. Nevertheless, we could see some of the things which would move into the vacuum created by the failure of communism. And to that extent, I think the transitions post-1989 have justified quite a lot of the kinds of understandings which the historians bring to this region.
Colleen O'Connor there in conversation with Professor Robert Evans. That's it from me, Peter Smith. I hope you've enjoyed the programme. Until next time, bye-bye.
Ici Radio Prague, programme en langue française des émissions internationales de la radio tchèque, onde courte. Pour bénéficier d'une agréable réception, voici la grille de nos horaires en temps universel et fréquence en kilohertz. Sept heures vingt-sept. Europe, 5930, 7345. 8h30, 8h57. Europe, 9860, 11600. 17h30, 17h57. Europe, Afrique centre, 5930, 15710. 19h30, 19h57. Europe, Afrique Ouest, 5930, 9430, 23h, 23h27. Amérique du Nord, 5930, 7345. Nous vous invitons à l'écoute sur le web. Pour cela, veuillez vous connecter au site www.radio.cz/français. Radio Prague est aussi sur le satellite. Vous trouverez toutes les informations sur notre site www.radio.cz/français.